The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
Pleasure having you waking up on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Boy, a tale of voter turnout looking a little bit different depending on where you happen to be. Oregon Public Broadcasting reported that in the Portland metro area, less than a quarter of registered voters have turned in ballots this week. So they're at less than 25%. That's interesting. Now, Jackson County at 33%. The state of Oregon overall at 29%. So Jackson County is overperforming that. We have Holly Morton, who, of course, is the chair over the Josephine County Republican Party. Do you have any stats from Joe County at this point, Holly? Welcome back to the show.
Numbers? Yeah, I didn't know we were going to talk about that. But no, I did.
I just saw that. I was just thinking, well, I have you on to talk about school board stuff, but I thought maybe off the top of your head you had something there. I didn't know.
Yeah, I do. Hold on a second, and I'll grab them so I don't give you any misinformation.
Yeah, sorry about that. I didn't mean to, you know, kind of sandbag you there.
No, it's all right.
Okay.
Let's talk about that. Actually, I don't have them in front of me. I can get those for you, though. I usually get those from Michael.
Yeah, well, I know that Josephine County I have a feeling Josephine County's voter turnout is probably very equivalent to Jackson County. I'll bet it's quite active.
Well, let me give you a feeling for it. I don't have last night's numbers, but from the few days before, voter turnout was just huge for Republicans. I mean, we're really getting the vote out, and especially in the county, less so in the city, as I call.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Republicans were 49% of the whole of voter turnout.
All right. Well, give me the numbers whenever you get a chance. Send me a text message or whatever. So I'm sure it's looking good there. That's good. That's kind of an aside.
It is looking good. But what's really weird is that the NABs are really coming out. NABs normally don't. NAB voters, non-affiliated voters, generally don't come out. But this year they're really coming out, which we find real super interesting.
Yeah, that could be interesting because NABs could be good or bad for conservatives because a lot of NABs end up trending left because the state overall is a little blue. I don't know if that's the case in Joe County or not, or Jackson County.
Well, it usually they run about 50-50 here. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's going to be really interesting. The fact that they're coming out, they were at 18%, and usually they only get NABs only represent about maybe 18% of the whole vote, but they've got 18 or 19% of the vote as of a couple days ago.
Okay, all right. Well, so Holly, if you can get some hard numbers out of that, just text messages to me or email or something. We'll make sure to mention that.
I can get that for you in just a minute.
All right.
Didn't have them up on my computer at the time.
I'll tell you what, though. What I did want to talk with you about, though, and it's a story I haven't paid much attention to. I know Daily Courier did an article on this the other day ago, and it has to do with an investigation and complaints against a couple of school board members in Josephine County. And it is Chad Dibdahl and Nathan Siebel.
Right.
And they're being investigated, apparently. There's a complaint filed against them by a school, Grants Pass School District librarian apparently,
right,
about this. And what do you know about that? I know that you go to a lot of these meetings, and I don't because I don't have any kids there, don't live there. But how do you see this? What's going on? Because it has to do with school board members trying to get control of what's happening in the library, where it's not just, absolutely every LGBTQ promoting book in the world that taxpayers are paying for. At least that's kind of how I figured it was being portrayed. But naturally, the librarians look at it differently. But how do you see it?
In a general sense, several members of the board are trying to keep the books age appropriate, and they don't want things that are pervasively vulgar or unnecessarily sexually explicit in the library.
Because some of those LGBTQ promoting books are pretty vulgar. In fact, and arguably child pornography, Holly, okay?
Right, right. They're not concerned about whether it's LGBTQ or whatever.
Gentlemen,
that's not their bent. Their bent is just explicitly vulgar books in general.
Okay.
You know, we don't. And anything that is not age appropriate for kids, especially put in the wrong parts of the library. Now, I was somebody dropped off something about some of the books that, had been removed. And you read that, and you cannot believe that those would be in a children's library at all. I mean, most of the time, if that kind of information had been passed around to kids, you'd be in trouble because it's so inappropriate. It's even inappropriate for, adults. It's just ugly, ugly, ugly stuff. But so what they've been trying to do is make sure that these sexually explicit books are not in the library. So there have been, they have removed some of the books, but now what these guys are wanting to do is have a policy about what can be in the library mm-hmm. so that they don't have to read every single book. So apparently the librarian got a little bit upset about it. But what people can do if they want to weigh in on it is on November 19th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. in the Grants Pass High School Commons, there's going to be a meeting about it in the Commons area. And parents who are concerned about this sort of thing need to get to that meeting, because I am quite sure that parents don't know what we're talking about, how vulgar those books are. They had, some books about rape, that kind of thing. And I can tell you that people who have been raped are not interested in reading about rape. There's no reason that they need to have books about rape in a high school library.
I have seen other school board members across the country here, Holly, that would actually start reading books from these various. They would be in open meetings, and they would, and then parents would start reading right. from these books that have been called into question. And right. they're being shouted down by the, hey, this is inappropriate for you to be doing this in our meeting, et cetera, et cetera. And then the parents and or the officials that were raising this would say, oh, but it's okay for us to be buying these books and giving them to the kids, in essence. So is that the sort of tactic here that Chad Dibdahl and Nathan Siebel are going about? Is that sort of their agenda as they're going down this road here?
Well, they want citizens to realize what their children are being exposed to. And, I am very impressed with these guys. I think it's super important, and we need to have these policies in place. But meanwhile, you have a whole group of people that feel like it's important that children are exposed to whatever they think they need to be exposed to. Hmm. So they should be in the library for kids. And these guys have had a lot of courage because these books are absolutely disgusting. And, I'm really not a prude. I just look at this stuff, and I would not want to read it at this age. 70 years old, I wouldn't want to look at it.
Well, the question should be, shall taxpayer funds be used to buy these books? And they'll talk about, and I know where their librarian's going to come by. Librarian, the American Library Association is a policy group which politically is to the left of the hardest communist that comes. Okay, that's just the reality of where the American Library Association is. And they talk about free speech, free speech, free speech. This has nothing to do with free speech, because no one's talking about banning books. We're talking about, should the taxpayers of the Grants Pass School District be forced to pay for certain books? And
well, you can certainly look at it fiscally. But yeah. If you want to look at it just developmentally, kids are in school to get an education. And what they are exposed to in the process of education, that should be up to the parents and the community, not some library association that thinks kids should be exposed to absolutely everything. And there are things that are age appropriate from kindergarten, on up.
Yeah, no one's talking about the public library. No one's talking about the public library. Or you were talking
Correct.
About the
We're
school,
about
the school library,
high school library,
right?
Right.
Okay.
And right. And so that's what they're trying to do. They're ratcheting it down, saying that we don't believe that this sort of book needs to be in a high school library because it should not be part of the educational process. And if you think about it, as young men are developing their sexuality, you want to be careful what they're exposed to read. You would like to think that they would be exposed to the loving, caring side of sexuality, not rape and various, you know, various pretty upsetting aspects of sexuality.
Yeah, well, I would still say but the school board are the school board is the elected representative of the parents, okay? They are the elected representatives. Right. They are supposed to be setting policy. Now, granted, the librarian's supposed to be running the library, but still, ultimately, the school board is there to set the policy, not the American Library Association.
Exactly. And interestingly enough, I called a couple of school board members to say what's going on with this. And I don't want to call out names here, but I spoke to one who said, I really can't talk about it because this is all done behind, you know, in executive session behind closed doors. I really can't talk about it.
Okay.
Well, how did it end up in the newspaper? I don't know, on the front page of the newspaper. I think it should be very open door. So anyway, parents who are concerned about this should plan on going to that meeting on November 10th.
Well, at that point, the election hysteria is all over at that point. Who knows if the hysteria is over, but, you know, hey, that's all past. So parents have no excuse not to get involved in this meeting, okay? There we go.
Right. Put it on your calendar for November 19th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Get in and let them know that we don't want our children exposed to this sexually explicit, pervasively vulgar, that's the kind of thing. Sexual explicitness with teenagers, knowing what goes where and that sort of thing, the biology of things, well, that's fine. But pervasively vulgar or unnecessarily or extremely sexually explicit.
The reason we have parents and the reason we have, supposedly people in authority in schools is to make judgment calls. You know, that's what we are there for. Otherwise, what's the point? You know, what's the point of being an official to say, okay, put it in. I'm just going to say, whatever it is, it's a book. And hey, it's pretty gross and juicy, but hey, we're going to put it in here. Freedom of speech. Right. No, we have the right. And frankly, I would dare say the duty to be involved in such policy. So once again, it's going to be on the 19th, November 19th. And I'm sure we'll remind people as we get a little closer to that, Holly. Okay.
Right. Very good.
Thanks. All right.
Bill.
All right. Thanks for at least shining a little light on that one. I'll have to read a little bit more on it and keep up on it. So the 19th should be pretty interesting times in Joe County, 732. KMED 99.3 KBXG. This is the Bill Meyer Show.
There's been a crew of roofers out there for nearly three decades.
Independent and serving the Rogue Valley for over 40 years.
This is News Talk 106.3 KMED. And you're waking up with the Bill Meyer Show.
Conspiracy Theory Thursday. A lot of time for open phones, especially after 8 o'clock this morning. And we'll be... anytime you have Conspiracy Theory Thursday and open phones, it's just a lot of fun. We'll be talking about anything that happens to be on your mind. We're also going to have the Diner 62 Real America quiz before we wrap up. Good question. I love some of these historical questions that we get a chance to explore on Diner 62's quiz, okay? Coming up after news, though, we're going to talk with Kevin B. Smith. Kevin B. Smith cuts against my grain a little bit, and... because I've had mixed emotions. I remember back during the Trump administration, the first Trump administration, the Republicans were falling sway to the Kim Kardashians of the world coming in and saying, oh, my gosh, there are so many people of color in prison because they were smoking a joint on the city streets. And it was sort of overblown, I thought. And I think in some ways, the sentencing reform that was done has caused more harm than good. But Kevin has written a book, Kevin B. Smith, and he's done this kind of, he's written several books over the years. In fact, he even wrote a book about liberals, conservatives, and the biology of political differences. I might have to ask him a little bit about that before we talk about his new book. But I've been reading this off and on over the last few weeks. It's called The Jailer's Reckoning, How Mass Incarceration is Damaging America. So he's making the case, he thinks, that we put too many people in prison, too expensive, and they were not really being effective about it, kind of... picking up where the sentencing reforms of the Trump administration left off. And I'm kind of curious, you know, that's an interesting sale in a time in which a lot of people in society don't seem to be punished. And so we'll talk with him about that and see what he has to say. And, of course, take your calls on it, too. This is the Bill Meyer Show.
We're here with Susan, who had her well drilled by Clouser Drilling. Susan, what made you choose Clouser?
I checked around KMED.
Proud to bring Kevin Smith on. He has been studying and teaching state politics and policy for more than 20 years. 20 long years. He's author or co-authored 9 books, including Predisposed, Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences. I'm intrigued by that. We'll talk about that just briefly here, but the book we're mostly going to be focusing on is also very thought-provoking, The Jailer's Reckoning, How Mass Incarceration is Damaging America. Kevin, welcome to the show. Good morning, sir.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the invitation, Bill. I hear it's Conspiracy Thursday. I hope the book doesn't fall into that category.
Nope, it just happened to be. Originally, we were going to talk to you Monday or Tuesday. I forget what it was, and it just didn't work out. We were just too many conflicts going on. But I wanted to make sure we could flesh this out, because there has been a lot of talk about mass incarceration and the issues with that in the United States. But first, I wanted to ask you, that last book of yours, Predisposed, Liberals, Conservatives, and the Biology of Political Differences, are you talking about almost a genetic predisposition as to our political orientations and our way of looking at the world? That's a little fascinating.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. Political orientation is heritable, and not only is it heritable, it's more heritable than a lot of other traits, like sexual orientation or alcoholism. Ideology is 40 to 60% heritable. So, yeah, the genetic predispositions is exactly what we're talking about. And I do want to emphasize predispositions. That's why we titled the book that way. It's not predetermined.
Yeah, not predetermined, but you will tend to lean this way. Okay, so what's going to happen now? Will the people be plumbing the database at 23andMe? And then the political activists figure out, oh, your genes say that you should be a Democrat or a Republican or something. Could we get that granular with it someday? I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's a theoretical possibility. I mean, you joke, but at least in theory, that is possible. I mean, the thing that makes that so tough is that these predispositions, it's not a product of a single gene or a handful of genes. It's probably hundreds or even thousands of genes having a small, tiny effect. So figuring that all out down on a granular level, I mean, that's going to take, some science that is certainly beyond my capabilities, that's for sure.
All right. Where do you teach state politics, by the way? Where do you teach?
I am at the University of Nebraska.
Very good. Good. Glad to hear this. So The Jailer's Reckoning is very thought-provoking. I've been reading this off and on over the last few days, how mass incarceration is damaging America. And it's an interesting time to be bringing this up, especially because we've gone through arguably last 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years or so of a rising chaos, especially in some of our cities, in which people who probably should have been incarcerated were not touched or even charged, according to some. And then other people getting charged intensely for political crimes, in essence, to some, in their opinion. And where do you even start with something like this?
To take your first point first, I mean, one of the things that I address in the book is how mass incarceration can affect social cohesion, which, you know, one of the consequences of that is, you know, some of the social kinds of breakdowns that you were just mentioning. And this is because, you know, 90% of people who get locked up for a felony offense are released back into the general population at some point. And part of, one of the knock-on consequences of 40 years of mass incarceration is not just that we've got a big prison population, we have a massive ex-prison population.
Ah.
And the experience of incarceration that's a powerful socialization experience. We've got an election coming up next week, as I'm sure you and all your listeners are aware. One of the consequences of having a big ex-prison population is it can actually affect things like turnout.
In what way?
People who have served prison terms are much less likely to vote. They're much less likely to participate. I mean, no one has an exact figure, but, you know, a reasonable estimate that a number of studies have suggested is turnout amongst that population is only 35%. Effectively, what's sitting there, Bill, is this huge pool of kind of untapped potential voters I mean, my rough estimate would be there's roughly 10 million potential voters there.
Oh, okay. Well, if you're talking about presidential politics, well, President Trump is technically a convicted felon, technically, right? You know, so maybe.
Well, and you joke about that.
Yeah.
You know, the one of the things that I talk about in the book is the only survey of a prison population that I could locate was done by the Marshall Fund. And it's kind of an old survey now. It was done in 2016. But, you know, one of the questions it asked prisoners was, who would you like to see president of the United States? And do you know who got the biggest number of votes
who?
Of incarcerated people? It was Donald J. Trump.
It was? Really?
Yes.
Oh.
28%. No one else came close.
That is interesting.
So, you know, you joke, Bill, but, you know, you can argue about, you know, was Donald Trump's conviction a case of prosecutorial overreach or not?
Yeah, and certainly there's a good case to be made either way on either side of these things. But, yeah, you're right. So I didn't know about that particular survey. Well, that's interesting. But
And you know, Republicans tend not to pay attention to the ex-prison population because they assume that they're going to vote Democrat. And there are good reasons for making that assumption. But that assumption is far from 100%. And, you know, if Donald Trump is, like it or not, he's a convicted felon. I mean, that gives you a basis to reach out to those potential voters that Kamala Harris does not have.
Yeah, being a prosecutor, which, of course, she cut her teeth on that, supposedly. All right, Kevin, now, in The Jailer's Reckoning, though, you talk about a mass incarceration problem, but you don't think it's really a federal incarceration problem, right? If I recall correctly, I mean, I know there's a big federal prison system, but it's really a state system that you're turning your eyes on. Would that be a fair assessment of this book?
Yeah, that'd be an absolutely fair assessment. One of the things that I don't think enough people understand when they're talking about this issue is the issue is really not a federal issue. It's a state issue. There's roughly, give or take, 2 million people sitting behind bars in the United States, and 1.5 million of them are in state prisons. You know, it's not the federal system that is holding the vast majority of people sitting behind bars.
Now, I noticed that you have a chart in the book, which, by the way, is very thought-provoking. It is The Jailer's Reckoning, all right? So Oregon is somewhere in the middle of the incarceration rate. In fact, a little bit less than in the middle, a little more lenient, but not incredibly lenient, as contrasted with some other ones. So what are some of our most highly incarcerated states? I think Louisiana was top of the chart, if I recall correctly, right?
Right. The states that have the higher incarceration rates tend to be concentrated in the South. So you're talking Louisiana, Georgia, Alabama, those kind of states.
Why do you think that is? What drives that?
Yeah, I don't think I don't think there's a single answer to that. And one of the things that I really try to tackle in the book is there are a lot of people out there who try to come up with sort of like these single cause explanations. You know, it's the war on drugs, it's systemic racism, it is elected judges or elected DAs. I think all of that plays a role. But the single biggest predictor of an incarceration rate that I found, and wading through 40 years worth of data and doing a bunch of statistical analyses, is violent crime. You know, you show me a state with a high incarceration rate, and chances are it's got a higher than average violent crime rate.
Oh, okay. So that a high incarceration rate is a violent state, or there tends to be people with a greater tendency overall to be committing violent crime, right?
And I mean, there's other contextual factors that matter. I mean, you know, do you have elected DAs? Have you got a more conservative or more progressive leaning electorate? You know, structural factors like, is it a three strikes law state? I mean, there's a number of factors that go into it. But the bottom line you know, the single biggest predictor of why people end up in state prisons is violent crime. And one of the things I've been a little bit surprised at is, you know, I'm out talking to people in the book is, you know, some people push back at me a little bit when I talk about that, but it's true by definition. I mean, more than 60% of the people who are sitting in state prisons have been convicted of a violent crime. So violent crime has to play a causal factor somewhere, right?
Yeah, and yet people would say that if there's one person who should probably be behind bars and taken out of societal presence would be someone who has committed personal violence crimes against people. Wouldn't you agree? That would be what we rely on.
Absolutely. I mean, people who commit these sort of, you know, egregious acts of social predation, you know, they murder, rob, commit rapes. I think society is perfectly justified in, picking them up and putting them behind bars. You know, the argument that I'm sort of like making in The Jailer's Reckoning is not arguing against that. It's arguing for a clearer-eyed view of what happens when we take that to an extreme.
How do you think it ends up damaging society overall?
Well, it does it in a number of ways. I mean, we were talking a little bit earlier about the erosion of social cohesion. You know, some communities have effectively been hollowed out because there's sort of like a revolving door between, you know, members of that community, especially young males, and the criminal justice system. And that really causes problems with not just social trust, but social cohesion. There's also an economic cost. I mean, it's not cheap to lock people up. Last time I looked in Oregon, it cost the taxpayers, I think it was a tick under $80,000 a year to lock someone up.
Yeah, it's not cheap. You're right.
Yeah, it's not cheap. And in the book, one of the things that I keep coming back to is what I call the tuna fish sandwich test.
Yeah, this is something that was interesting, and I wanted to ask you a question about this, and it has to do with a fellow named Larry Dayries. Is that how you pronounce his name, right?
Yep, that's correct.
What happened with him?
Yep.
What happened to Larry?
So Larry, kind of had a tough life. He had drug problems and mental health problems. He did have some brushes with the law, and he walked into a whole.
He walked into a what? I think we lost him. Let me get him back on.
Are we back, Bill?
Yeah, we're back, Kevin. Thanks for calling back right away, okay?
Yeah,
worked
no
okay.
Worries.
Yeah, so Larry had a rough life, mentally ill, mental problems, drug problems, and he got popped for, about 70 years in prison in Texas. And what happened to send him there?
Yeah. So what he did is he stole a tuna fish sandwich from the deli counter at a Whole Foods in Austin, Texas. And Texas is a three-strike state. That was his third strike. And he got 70 years for it. And, you know, that is going to end up costing the taxpayers of the state of Texas millions of dollars to incarcerate this guy. And, you know, what I call the tuna fish sandwich test is we need to take, or at least in my opinion, we need to take a look at, you know, is something like that really worth millions of dollars? I mean, what is the social cost benefit analysis here of, you know, locking this guy away basically for the rest of his life for stealing a tuna fish sandwich and paying through the nose to make it happen?
If you don't mind me prying a little bit on this with Larry's case, did he have a bunch of, because we have a similar three strikes law in Oregon, it's called Measure 11, similar type of situation. I don't think it has to do with theft of a tuna sandwich specifically, but, you know, I could be wrong about this. I'm not a prosecutor. But did he have a lot of violent crimes and a lot of interaction with the law at the point where he just had so many strikes against him that just stealing that sandwich made him go away?
Yeah, he did have quite a few priors, and not just in Texas, but also in Louisiana. I couldn't quote you chapter and verses on whether they were all violent or not, but they did include things like burglary, I think, those sorts of things. So you know, reasonably serious crimes. And Bill, I think if you are, you know, if you're willing to argue, yeah, sorry, you've got a record of this and, you know, so sad, too bad, we're going to lock you up because you've just had your third strike and we're not putting up with it anymore.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but so I get that. But boy, you know, to spend $1 million or more to, you know, keep him locked up in Texas doesn't. I don't know how productive that is, a productive use of taxpayer money that is either. But at the same time, I would imagine that Texas is very much, you know, they're tired of people running roughshod, you know, over people. Because I have to tell you, you know, the stealing, the shoplifting, the burglary, the break-ins and things like that, those are quality of life crimes that really irritate, you know, people in communities. And I think they rise up on stuff like that. Could that be one of the issues that you're dealing with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, how can you not sympathize with people living in those communities dealing with those issues? And I think it's perfectly understandable that one of their responses to dealing with those issues in their community is to sort of like put pressure on legislators to pass crime laws that will, you know, severely punish these people. And, you know, and that's a perfectly principled and defensible argument. As long as you are, okay, I accept the consequences. Mm-hmm. And part of those consequences means, you know, if you're in Oregon, we're going to be paying $80,000 a year per person that we lock up.
I wonder why we pay $80,000 while other states like, didn't you mention Nebraska is like $25,000 or $30,000 a year? Or maybe it's Texas that charges less.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's Texas, or at least a few years ago. I mean, you know, some of that is economies of scale. Some of that is whether you are using sort of like a, private prisons or not. Some mm-hmm. of it is on, you know, the pay scales of, you know, guards and that sort of thing. Some of it is based on, how you can use prisoners as a cheap labor pool to support the institution. So I think there's various factors there.
You know something, by the way, I'm talking with Kevin Smith, Kevin B. Smith, the Jailer's Reckoning, how mass incarceration is damaging America. There is a pretty significant, you know, percentage of Americans' population within the prison system in the United States when contrasted with the rest of the world. Is there a possibility that our mavericky culture, even the, you know, the revolutionary style culture may have influenced some of this? And frankly, the people that don't want to be controlled much, maybe they all live here. Or is there something darker that's going on that we have, for some reason, that so many Americans seem to be behaving badly? Do you have any thoughts on that, Kevin? I don't know if you want to go there or not.
I'm willing to follow you a little ways down that path, Bill, because I do think there's something to what you're saying. I mean, I think I would start out by saying that, you know, by most metrics, the United States is a more violent place than, you know, other comparable liberal democracies. So certainly that plays a role in it. But, you know, what you're getting at is, you know, the United States is, you know, compared to other liberal democracies, we're more individualistic and we're just a more rambunctious, more centered on our own individual freedoms.
Yes.
And one of the consequences of that, especially if you've got a huge, diverse, you know, different races, different religions, different ideologies, different viewpoints, basically what you're going to get is a lot of social conflict. And if people aren't sort of like restraining individual behavior as much as they are in other countries, you know, one of the end results of that is some of those conflicts are going to, you know, manifest themselves in ways that, you know, are going to violate some criminal laws.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you can understand why sometimes Americans will look at what happens in our criminal justice system right now, where we would rather let a guilty person go free than to punish, you know, a non-guilty person, if at all possible. But there are times that, you know, they look at a place like Singapore. I'll even joke about that. You know, sometimes I just want to say, okay, I want to cane them all. You know, you just want to be. And yet, I know that's not the American way. It's like, would we really want to live in a Singapore type society? It's very clean, very orderly. But boy, you better not drop any gum on the street. You know what I'm getting at? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there's this tension always within our society between.
I mean, you go that far, and that's really encroaching upon, you know, individual liberty in a way that I don't think would be tolerated in the United States. But, you know, related to what you're saying, Bill, I mean, there's a big argument that it was really big in the 1980s and 1990s that, you know, sort of like really pushing incarceration would have a deterrence effect. You know, if you sort of like change the cost benefit calculus of engaging in criminal activity, if there's a reasonable probability that you do it, you're going to get caught and you're going to get banged up for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some evidence to support that it did do that. The mass incarceration did suppress, you know, especially violent crime. The problem with that is it has diminishing marginal returns. You know, at some point, you know.
So you can double the amount of people in prison. That's not necessarily going to half the amount of crime again. Right out there.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think we should be doing if you had your magic wand? And I know you talk in the book about looking at other countries and how they will tend to look at criminal justice in, almost in a more holistic way. Would that be fair? You know, kind of a.
Yeah. You know, no, I think that's fair. I mean, if I could wave my magic wand, Bill, it would be not necessarily at the policy level, at the legislative level, but at the mass level. I think a lot of people, you know, whether they're on the conservative end of things or on the progressive end of things, look at this in far too simplistic a terms. You know, one of my favorite economists is Thomas Sowell,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, his phrase is, there's no solutions, there's only trade-offs.
That's true. That's true.
And if I could wave my magic wand, you know, what I would want to happen is for everyone to recognize that, A, this is a critically important issue that affects everybody. I mean, if you're a taxpayer, it affects, you know, it affects you. And, you know, two, you have to sort of like be conscious of the trade-offs. You've got to sort of like, you know, let go of the bumper sticker and apply the tuna fish sandwich test. And I think if that happened at the level of popular opinion, the legislative follow-up would take care of itself.
In Oregon here, especially in Southern Oregon, we're struggling with a big homeless and a crime problem from the homeless. And a lot of this brought on from drug addiction because Oregon decided that, well, decriminalizing street drugs was the way to go, Kevin. I'm sure you're, you know, familiar with what happened. We're trying to reverse that now. But, you know, the criminal damage is happening. It is happening out there. And in Jackson County, our jail space is very small and it's inadequate. And there's probably not $200 million to be able to expand that. And yet we're told that, the only way we're going to get people treated for drugs to keep them from off the street and committing crime is to get them in the criminal justice system. Do you go into the book about delivering those kind of services within the justice system, and is it effective? Do you know off the top of your head?
Yeah, there's a lot of variation there, Bill. I mean, there's a lot of people and a lot of programs, you know, really giving it a good effort. And some of these programs are more successful than others. I mean, you know, I'm out of my wheelhouse talking about, you know, the problems that are specific to Oregon and what it's dealing with. But
okay.
I know I was in Portland a few years ago, and I walked downtown to Powell's, which is, you know, one of the greatest bookstores.
Yeah, great bookstore. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's closed. It closed now, did it? Or did it not close? I thought it closed.
I don't know. I hope it didn't close. That was one of my favorite bookstores. But anyway, I was a little shocked at the level of, very, very visible homelessness in downtown Portland. And I think part of the problem in dealing with those sorts of issues is kind of like once you've let the genie out of the bottle, you know, once you have, effectively decriminalized drug use or even public drug use, and then it turns out to have all of these social knock-on effects, that can sort of like, you know, result in, higher crime in neighborhoods and property values and declining and that sort of thing. Once you figure that out, it's really hard to go back to what you had before.
Mm.
It's not just laws, Bill. It's social norms and social values. They are hard to build up. They're easy to tear down, and once they're gone, they're hard to recapture.
And arguably, we've become a low-trust society because of this. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I've got a whole chapter in the book where I talk about how mass incarceration is helping to reduce social trust in society. And I think that is one of the unintended downstream consequences of mass incarceration that we just have not fully grappled with.
Kevin, I was reading an article. Gosh, I forget where it was. I have it saved someplace in my archive someplace. And it was talking about how they ended up handling incarceration or reducing incarceration. And I think in a Scandinavian nation, I don't know if you caught that article. I think it was in one of the national newspapers. And they had a very different approach to it. It wasn't that they didn't want to, you know, keep you, you know, locked up, but they put you in more of kind of a prison village sort of thing. Did you ever see anything like that? Ever heard about countries that have been doing that and how they seem to have a much better time at stopping recidivism, you know, and people would manage to change their lives around. Have you ever heard about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure in regards to the specific article that you're talking about, but in Europe, one of the things that they try to do to reduce recidivism is keep convicted criminals close to the community.
Mm.
How
does that help when you keep them close to the community instead of them sending them hundreds of miles away to the state pen, you know, that kind of thing?
Well, it makes it easier to reintegrate. It makes it easier to maintain those social connections. I mean, if you are, you know, 150 miles away in a state pen, I mean, it's hard for your family and your friends to maintain a connection with you. So if you disappear for 5 years, when you come back, a lot of those social connections are essentially been frayed or even completely severed. And so the social cohesion is reduced. Whereas if you're serving some, you know, a term in sort of like, for lack of a better term, a prison village that's close to your community, it's easier to maintain those social networks. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't think about is, and, you know, when you were talking about the problems in some communities in Oregon to do with, you know, crime associated with homelessness and drugs, that's exactly the sort of thing that can happen when these social connections start to dissolve.
Huh. And, you know, I was thinking about that, keeping the social connections. Of course, violent crime more often performed by young men. We know that, right? Statistically, it's pretty, you know, pretty clear on things like that. And let's face it, men don't tend to have as rich a social connection as a rule, than women. Would you agree with me on that? You know, so much, so far.
Yeah, I think the research would bear that out. Yes,
yeah.
I would agree with that.
And so I could see then what you're talking about, where keeping people, if they're in prison, closer to their communities, men have enough trouble keeping social networks together or keeping connections with family, and, you know, and so maybe that would help over in the long term. That would be a sea change, though, in state policy, wouldn't it, as far as imprisonment would go and incarceration?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I am not even going to pretend to downplay the significant, you know, challenges that you'd face politically and trying to sort of like revamp the criminal justice system along those lines. I mean, for one thing, you know, they say, you know, show me a budget and I'll show you your value.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I will certainly tell you, I have a feeling that this reckoning that you're talking about, the jailer's reckoning, will probably have to be approached in our society at some point in the near future, but not maybe for the reason you're thinking. But we're at this point now between the debt of the United States and the inability to tax people enough to be able to do everything that they want. Insolvency and budgeting is probably going to have more to do with reforming sentencing than anything else. Would you agree or not? I'll give you the final word on that.
I think that's a definite possibility. Right now, state governments combined spend the equivalent of the budget of the United States Marine Corps every year on locking people up. And that's a lot of money. And, you know, could that play a role in forcing this reckoning that I you know, spend a book exploring. Yeah, I think absolutely.
Yeah, and coming up with a different method rather than sending someone 250, 300 miles away, in Oregon's case, in order to do this kind of stuff. I mean, there are always going to be some people, though, that, I mean, you'll agree that there got to be some people that just need to be put away and put away hard, right? You're not talking about the, you know, fire the police and open the prisons. That's not what you're proposing, correct?
No, absolutely not. I mean, in my family, I have people who serve in law enforcement. I also have people who have served prison terms. And I'm not an unusual American in that sense. And so I hope I have... I call it a grumpy dad centrist view of things. And part and parcel of that view is, yeah, there are some people who commit such, you know, outrageous criminal acts. Heck yeah, we should lock them up.
The Jailer's Reckoning, How Mass Incarceration is Damaging America. I've gotten through about a third of it so far, and I'm looking forward to it. It's very thought-provoking. And like I said, some of it I kind of go, yeah, other things not so much. But I appreciate you doing this. And I think I'm going to want to pick up a copy of Predisposed, too. I'm fascinated with that concept of that book there, too. Kevin B. Smith. Kevin, where can people find out more about this particular book, The Jailer's Reckoning?
The easiest way to find out about it, Bill, is just to hop onto my website, which is easy to find. It's kevinbsmith.com.
That's easy.
So B as in Boston, all lowercase, just kevinbsmith.com.
Appreciate the time. Thanks for the talk.
Thank you, Bill. And I hope your listeners give the book a chance. I think it's an important issue.